The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Buonasera. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening. It's my pleasure to be here, what would I be here if you weren't all here? Wouldn't be anything. So I want to thank you for being here. I think it's a nice rapport between the two of us, but I think we're all here also for in support of this great institution, which is a public library. We just had a little meeting upstairs, and I was talking about my library experience. I came to the States. I was 12 years old. I was an immigrant from Italy with the family, the four of us. And in my quest to learn as quickly as possible the language, what about America, I used to hang around the library a long time during the day. And I felt that the library was, I felt comfortable in the library. And, of course, the resources there for what I needed were free. And I had access to all of them. So I truly appreciate the institution for what it stands and the service that a library gives to the community. I mean, much in the same thought, I choose to be on public television because it's accessible to everybody and it's a venue of education, information that is valid, that has substance, and that's where I'm going to be with my show. So thank you. So, having said that, a few years have passed since that 1958 and on, and the opportunity of coming to America, and again, that was a question that was posed a few minutes ago upstairs to me. I said, what I am, what I became is maybe out of two things. One, coming as an immigrant and with my parents and seeing the nostalgia, the difficulties that my parents had in adjusting, specifically my father, to this new land, with difficulties with the language and with the customs, that, in me came that I need to prove them right. They did this for me and for my brother, and I need to prove that they did the right thing, that they gave me an opportunity. And I think that is a driving force that's behind me. I love what I do tremendously. So that's what took me further. But I think, what propelled me, what got me started was that, to really thank my parents and say, listen, you were right in your decision. And, of course, the second is the fact of the opportunity in America. And, only in America, and it's only in America. That I don't think anyplace else could have happened. And, my history maybe better than I do. And last time I was here, we talked about how I began and in the restaurant business and so on. Well, I'm going to pick it up now. Maybe I began the restaurants, the books, the television, now some wine and products. But I became, and now what is my role in the industry? I mean, I love communicating. I love teaching. So I think that I'm at a point almost of a mentor. And it's a great position to be. I think when I have an opportunity to work with my chefs, with anybody that works for me, and I am able to communicate to them and energize them and give them wisdom, and I see them grow, that's great satisfaction for me. It really is tremendous. And one would say, Lydia, you have how many restaurants? And we have several restaurants, I think, all in total, because we are partners with Mario Batale, my son Joseph, and myself. All in total, there's about 16 restaurants. How do you manage that? And it's not about an individual managing. Yes, there's a business plan, and it's about choosing wonderful people, people that have a passion, that have a profession, and energizing them and just sort of sending them on. So my growth and the growth of my family and the restaurants and all of that is about many, many talented people that sort of one touches and makes them move ahead and energize them in their own strengths. And it's in this way that I feel also that I touch a tremendous amount of people with my books and with my television. And being in a restaurant, cooking and seeing every night the people, you go out, you say hello, you have direct contact. It's almost like a stage, live stage. I mean, that's why an actor maybe instead of just being in movies really appreciate the stage because you have the direct return and impact. So a restaurant is like that. You cook a great meal, you send it out, the customer is there, they applaud you right away, and they give you that sense of thank you, a job well done, and you get that feedback right away back. To go beyond that, the venue of the book was the next for me. I found that tremendous, also an extension of what I wanted to say, put it down, record it in written form, and then send it out there. And like somebody tonight at one of the signings said, you know, Lydia, my birthday I spent at one of your restaurants last year. This year we're having a party, and it's a Lydia party, and everybody that comes there is going to bring a Lydia recipe. So you know, this is moving stuff for me to be able, in a way, to come into your homes and influence, to some extent, the flavors of what's in your family, what's in your on your table, what happens. It's very, very meaningful to me, and I feel quite responsible and connected. And I want to make sure. That's when I want to make sure that the book really works for you, that it really delivers those flavors. And another arm of that extension is, of course, the television, entering into people's home through the television. So I was blessed in a sort of a network of communicating with all of you out there, all of America. And my show now also is Australia, New Zealand, the Caribbean, Mexico, I think part of Canada. So, you know, when you think, and when I get emails from all these parts of the world, I think it's really moving for me as a sentiment of touching all of you. And say this too, so you can really understand how appreciative I am. Now, I hope that message really also enriches your life. One of the things that I hear, and it'll be open for questions after, so I'm kind of laying the groundwork for your questions because I want to answer what you want to know. As I said before, most likely you know my story as well as I do. But one of the questions or comments that I get on the internet, on the site, is about that extra element that they feel exists in my books or in the show, and that is the interest about family. What they love out there, what you all love and what I get a lot is this concentration on the family, on the table, on food, how food really is the connector, is the glue maybe to family ever more. Now, in these times when family is kind of searching for an identity and maybe getting closer and closer, you know, how can we do that? Well, certainly, as I express it in my books and in my television, what I do is not scripted. It is real life. That's what it is. That is my family. The show, the stage or the setting where the show is taped is my house. My mother does live upstairs. Every morning we have coffee in that kitchen. My daughter does live two blocks away, and she does walk. And sometimes you get a call, I'm going to drop the kids off. Give them something to eat. You know, things like that. But let me tell you, my mother at 88, she just loves that. the responsibility, and there's nothing that makes her happier or brings her alive than when she gets one of those calls. I'm sending the kids. Can you babysit and by the way, give them something to eat? So the family element and, you know, what role does food play into that? Well, you know, food is a basic. It's common to all of us. We all eat. We all need to eat to survive. So that's at the very basis. But from then, food also can grow. Food can give us much pleasure in the senses. Food can be a communicator of emotions, of love, of affection. And these are all the venues that maybe, I feel that way. When I want to do something, the best that I can do, I want to cook for you. I want to nurture you. I think maybe that is coming through on the shows. And out there, I think all of you want to do the same. And the table certainly is the venue. So we all eat. We all need because we need substance. Because at the moment that you sit at the table and that you begin to eat, your defenses are all down. You cannot take something in if you are resisting it. So it's almost an innate reaction that you are relaxed and you are taken in because that keeps you alive. At that moment, if you want to look at it at a psychological point of view, you are vulnerable. Not that you are vulnerable in a bad way, but you are open. So that's why the table is so important. You are eating, you're taken in because you are keeping yourself alive. You need to keep yourself alive. But at the moment, we're taking in that food. You take messages. You take suggestions. You take emotions in. You take sentiments in. So the table is such a special place. And one would say, oh, I can cook. But eating by yourself is not the same. It's not the same. You don't get that interaction. Why do we have business meals? Why do we have meals, you know, when you want to propose, you have a great meal or a special meal? Because at that point, you are more apt to communicate, to reach the person, the real person, without a resistance, a wall of resistance put up. Now, if you have your teenagers and you want to talk to them, you want to talk to them about sex, drugs, whatever, you invite them in the room and you say, let's talk. Well, it's a wall already. The resistance is there. It says, you know, what are you going to say? But if you get them at the table and the conversation starts and you begin to talk about it, one would say, well, maybe the table is not the right place. Wrong. The table is the perfect place. You know, I know that as an Italian table, you know, sometimes you're embarrassed also when you were a kid. I remember everything happened at the table. We ate, we drank, we sang. We cried, we argued, we walked away from the table or whatever. But all of those emotions really is emotions of connections. So I think that, you know, if there's, from in retrospect, looking at what I love to do, and that is cook and feed people and nurture people, what I sense from out there is that that connection at the table is something that everybody's looking for more and more. And it's as simple as putting some good food, and it doesn't have to be elaborate food and all of that, putting it regularly on the table, it becomes a magnet. And, you know, one would say, gee, oh, I can't cook. Everybody can cook, you know, because, again, going to the basics. You need to nurture yourself. You need to feed yourself. So we're all capable of handling food. We're all equipped of handling food to some extent. So you can all cook. If you want to get to specifics, then of course recipes and on, and you grow that. So when I hear somebody say, oh, I can't cook, I said, yes, you can. Just get in there and try it. And I think just the effort of, if that's not what you do best, the effort of cooking something, of putting it on the table, if there's I think some common sense and love and good fresh ingredients, I mean, you're halfway there. And, you know, what hopefully, you know, happens out there, and my message and whatever, is that these tables become ever more sort of in everybody's home, populated with good food, I would say, and maybe family around them. Also, I think that for professionals, another says that. So I'm giving you a kind of a feel of what the vibes I get from you guys. What I get a lot is professional people, specifically men, getting into cooking, and I think that's another way of loosening up and showing emotion. Maybe a professional man feel that, you know, they need to be very professional. They take that also into, they bring it at home. And food, getting in the kitchen and cooking, is a way of saying I love you to the family. And I understand, you know, a lot of my writings and fans and the come to the book are men, professional men, that says we love to cook. So if you're a professional, if you love to cook, get in the kitchen and begin cooking, because it really is good for you, your stress level, and it's love for your family. Maybe we will open it up a little bit to questions and so we can go into specifics. You know, you don't have to cook the best. Cook something, put it on the table with love, and gather everybody around. I think that's what we need more of.
So as Lydia just mentioned, we'll go to questions. If you have a question, I imagine there are some. Just raise your hand. We'll get you a mic. Please wait for the mic right down there.
Hi, Lydia. Hi. Thank you. I love you. going to the family and food aspect of what you were discussing, for you, what is the ultimate comfort food? You know, we eat for emotion as well, and so when you want to feel that comfort family feeling, what do you turn to?
I must say I turn to food that caresses me. What is that definition, caresses me? I think homemade pasta, gnocchis, good soups, good beans. But I think that has a direct correlation to your childhood and things that were cooked in your home and that made you feel good. I mean, you know, rice cooked with olive oil and sage, I think it's in the slice book. Used to love it as a kid. You know, we used to get a lot of that, you know, when there was nothing spectacular around. And I used to love it. It just used to make me feel so good. So I think it's related a lot to when one is young and what made them feel good at that time.
Another question? Right here in the third row.
Hi, Lydia. I was excited to hear that you have a children's book coming out, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And also along those lines, I'm curious how, as a woman in the food business coming up and as a mother, you managed both, and you did it so well so that today you have such a strong family unit.
I'll answer the last first. It is difficult. You know, the profession, the food profession, is a tough one, especially if you're talking about restaurants, late hours. For me, it was the family support, my mother living with me or above me or whatever. I was comfortable that my children were with her. But I had my first child was 3 years old when I opened the restaurant, and I remained pregnant with my daughter just in opening the restaurant. So I was in the restaurant business a year and something. My daughter was born. They were both fledglings in a sense. They needed attention and growth. And I felt guilty when the time came that, you know, after 2 months I would come back to work. And I said, how can I do that? So I tried it. And this is in 1972. And I was thinking, well, you know, psychiatrists weren't on my agenda, but I did go to the pediatrician. I said, you know, I have this heaviness, this guilt. I love what I do. I need to do it because, you know, we started something. We have an investment. We have loans to pay back. I need to raise my family, and you know, I'm a new mother. My baby needs me as well. And he was so wise. He said to me, children want happy families. They want a happy mother. And you need to do what you need to do to be happy. You will find the time. You need to find the time to give them love, to nurture them, to set them in situations that they feel secure. But you need to fulfill what you need to fulfill for you to be a complete individual. And I did that. I went ahead to secure the baby's well-being, of course, my mother being there and the support system. But what that led to is that I involved my children in everything because that was the time that I had with them. So if they came after school, we went to the restaurant, or they came there, or grandma brought them there with grandpa. They did their homework. We had dinner. They did their homework on tomato boxes or whatever. And then they went home. And we had a rule that if they didn't behave at home, my mother would call me. And if I came home, that was serious business. And so my mother, the kids even to this day tell my mother, grandma said, because she would dial my number, but she would dial an extra number or less a number. And so she would say, your mother's busy, and if I call her once more, she'll come. And now they tell her, grandma, you think we don't know that you dialed an extra number? But it was that kind of, you know, genuine. And then also in my research, they always came. A lot of research. I like research. That's what, you know, gives me the material, whatever. I still do it today. I used to take them all the time. That was family vacation. It wasn't research. So I brought them with me, whether I went to the wineries, whether I went to restaurants, whether I went to chefs. They always came along. The time that I had free, they were along, maybe on necessity and because I wanted them to be with me. And today, both of them are back working with me. And I think, you know, in retrospect, and when they were college age, I told them, I said, you don't want to do this business direct because, you know, high school, the restaurants look quite interesting, you know, party every night. So I said to them, no, mom has to do that. You have to get, we're in America, the opportunity, you need to get your education. And they both went on, you know, my son went on to Boston, then became a trader, an analyst. My daughter went on Georgetown, ultimately a PhD in Oxford. In Renaissance art history, they both work with me now. I think, all of those years that I kind of spent, they saw that, you know, what I did was I was passionate about it. I got rewarded with it, and they liked it. And they, with their specialty, they came back. So I think if you're a woman in an industry, for that matter, you know, I think that you need to relax a little bit. Think about yourself as well, you know, give yourself the opportunity to grow and to become, because if you're suffocating, you won't be happy and you won't relate. And just balance it out, the right time for them, for you, for everything else to work out. And just love them and have those good meals when you can and include them, and I think it will work. Thank you. Now, the first question was? The children's book. Yes, the children's book, it's coming out next December. And what it is Noni Tania's story, The Edible Christmas Tree. Now, in my family, whenever the kids come over, and for Thanksgiving, they all slept over for 3 days, the whole weekend. And ultimately, at the end, we get all together. They all pile up in my bed. And we if we watch something, we shut it off. And they said, Noni, now tell us a story when you were a little girl. And I do. I tell them all the story with my grandmother, with the chickens, with the geese, the goats, the everything. But this is about Christmas. And when I was a little girl, I'll tell you a story. the Christmas tree was different. It was never the tip of a big tree. It was actually the juniper berry bush we used to use a lot. It was a little bush like this, very dense, a nice bluish hue to it. And everything that we decorated with was edible. We had little apples. We had dried figs. We had we baked cookies. We fried the frittole, we made candy, wrapped the candy. So everything that we decorated was edible. And at the end, on January 6th, St. Nicholas was our present. We ate the tree. So the kids really love this kind of story. And this is the story of this book. We begin with my children. And we go, it's all cartoons. And the family is all the characters. It's the family that you watch on television. So all the kids and their names, and we tell the story of Christmas. And ultimately, at the end, I give all of the recipes. We make the recipes together. And the book has all the recipes so that mothers and children can do that together.
Okay. Great story. About 8 rows back there.
Hi.
Hi.
I just think you are so incredibly gracious and graceful. And I'm wondering if you've always been like that, seriously, since you've been little, or if it's something that you've had to teach yourself and be cognizant of, if that makes sense.
I think it's a little bit of all of that. I think that... I guess there was a graciousness in the women in my life, my grandmother and my great aunts and all of that. And, you know, the girls learning how to sew and do all of that. So there was a little graciousness to that part that came innate. I love softness. I think you can communicate. Maybe kindness is a much stronger communicator than anger and enforcefulness. And along the way, and I don't remember where I read it, but I read a very important thing that changed my mind. And they said, you know, there are emotions that become part of you and affect you. And if you don't learn how to shed them and not take them, they really can hurt you. Those being anger, hate, you cannot transport them. If you're angry, you can be angry at somebody, but the anger is with you. If you hate somebody, you can hate somebody, but the hate is with you. So those are the feelings that you have to shed. And I don't stay angry. I don't hate much. I like the positive feelings. So whenever I get caught, that doesn't mean that I hate something. I catch myself. I says, why? You know, just distance myself from that individual, that person, or whatever, or change it, and move on and be positive. So maybe that is what reflects in my mannerism.
Right here in the sixth row.
Hi. One of the things that I love about you, Lydia, is that you exude this warmth and comfort. And on one of your shows, you were in a small town in Italy, visiting a farm where he made cheese. And how you were relishing in the ricotta. And one of the things that I wanted to know is, one, what is the name of that town, if you remember? And two, can anyone visit that farm, or is it just a closed thing?
Oh, my God. If you look in the books, the last two books, Lydia Cooks from the Heart of Italy and Lydia's Italy before that, those are the books about the 20 regions of Italy, 10 regions each. Italy has 20 regions. So, with the recipes, you have my sentiments, my descriptions of my experiences there, and you will find some of those places that you're looking for. But, you know, I did so many cheese tasting, so many. Oh, my God. But maybe, you know, what comes to mind, I mean, I went right outside of, in Lazio, of Rome, I went to visit a buffalo farm, and they made buffalo mozzarella. And this animal, the water buffalo, is not indigenous to Italy. It came to Italy about 700 years ago from Asia. And it found the climate, the perfect climate around Rome and Naples, and it's thriving very well. And, of course, the milk is quite rich from buffalo, water buffalo, and they make that great mozzarella and ricotta. So I remember that visit vividly because it was drizzling and these beautiful animals. I mean, they're so beautiful. They were all sort of in a corralled and they're very curious. And they also have a leader and everybody follows. And they know their owner or their very much. So I would stay still and he would be next to me and they would come slowly because they were curious. And one of them sensed something, they all ran back. But then I gained their comfort, And I know I was in sandals, and I had my feet up there, and one of them came close and started licking my feet. Now, you know, I think maybe there I was taken by the moment and it had that buffalo mozzarella I might have that. So I don't know, but there's many of such moments. But that was a special moment.
Right here.
Oh, Lydia, I just love you, and I love your mother because she reminds me of my mother.
You.
And I was wondering, your place in Italy, could you tell us a little bit about that? And also, do you have an agriturismo in Italy now that we could come to?
We don't have an agriturismo, so, but we do produce wine on the Bastianich label. In Friuli Venezia Giulia, which is the region that we come from. So Friuli Venezia Giulia, if you're looking at Italy, is all the way up in the right-hand corner, and it's under Austria, it borders with Slovenia, and it touches the Adriatic Sea. Actually, it's attached to Istria, which is the peninsula that I was born after World War II, became communist, and that's why we escaped back to Italy and then on to the United States because of the political situation. But so I do have the grandmother's house, which is in Istria. I go there sometimes. But the winery where we stay most of the summer and the kids go is in Cividale del Friuli. Cividale del Friuli is a small town. It's a Longobard town. Now, you know, Italy, of course, the Romans traveled all over. So in Friuli the Romans came up and, of course, went across and into Istria and down to conquer the Middle East and so on. But from the north came the Longobards tribes. So Cividale reflects very much that, you know, because in Italy everything is, you kind of can tell by the architecture, by the monuments that were left behind. And I'm saying that because if you do go in that area, you must go visit Cividale and visit this. They have a Longobard, il Tempietto, they have a little temple from the Longobards, which is, I think, about 900 years old, and it's just beautiful, and you should visit. But there we have our vineyards and our home, and it's a great place. It's the best place in Italy for white wine. Now, you have the Alps across the north, and, of course, the Apennines going down Italy. So the Alps, of course, the little hills that lead up to the Alps are Il Colio, which is great for wine growing. And the blocking of the Alps to the north, and the sort of, it's like a concave that keeps the warm air coming from the sea. So the microclimate is extraordinary for grape growing, because it's great when the day is hot and the night is cool, or there's ventilation. It's very good for the formation of the flavonoid crystals in the grape itself. And so you could visit the winery. It's Bastianich, and you can go on the website and just www.bastianich.com. You will see that, or lydiasitaly.com. You will see everything. And then we have a winery in Maremma, which is in Tuscany, and there it's called La Mozza, and it's. Maremma is maybe a part of Tuscany that it's not known, but those of you that watched the show and you saw me on the horses and whatever, that's where I was. I was in Maremma. It's a very rustic part of Tuscany. So if you're looking at Tuscany, everybody knows Florence, then Siena. So if you go down from Siena going towards Rome on that coast, the old Via La Appia Antica, so the old Roman road, that's where Maremma is. It's very rustic. Florence being very Renaissance, Maremma is very medieval. So you see a lot of those castle stills, and it's beautiful. And we have the winery is just kind of being built. We've had it for a while. We grow the grapes, but and that one is called La Mozza. So you could visit. You can let us know if you're going. The Bastianich one is, if you're in Venice, you just go up 1 hour from Venice. It's beautiful. But we don't have an agriturismo, but maybe we can recommend one in the area for you. Okay.
And there's another one in the front row and then behind.
Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I have a question about cooking, about making a good pomodoro sauce. How important is it? I know I'm not using fresh tomatoes, but what do you think about a regular Roma tomato versus a San Marzano?
Okay. If you make a sauce and use canned tomatoes, that's perfectly fine. They're much better than using non-ripe, out-of-season regular tomatoes. The difference between Roma and San Marzano is different in the species. The Roma is round and plump, long, but more on the roundish side. The San Marzano looks a little sexy, like a body of a lady. It has that indentation like an hourglass, kind of with a little tip. What makes both of these tomatoes great for sauce is that they have thin skin, lots of pulp, very few seeds. The seeds is what makes the sauce bitter. And you want a lot of pulp, because otherwise, if you use the different tomatoes, it's very watery. It's bitter because there's a lot of seeds, and so all the elements that you don't want. So that's why either of those tomatoes are fine. The San Marzano is a variety that grows. San Marzano is a town outside of Naples. And if they're really from San Marzano, because sometimes they can be just San Marzano species or style, not grown in San Marzano. But what makes it special if they really come from San Marzano is that that's still volcanic soil from the different eruptions, so it's a virgin soil. It's a lot of nourishment, and also it's a bit kind of metallic, and it really reflects the sun and heat, so the tomato ripens from the bottom and from the top. So if you get a real San Marzano from San Marzano, there's that little extra sweetness and pulp and very few seeds and the skin, even though you remove it. But if there's any left, it disintegrates.
Mm-hmm. When are you opening a restaurant?
Okay. You have a lot of good restaurants here. You really, a lot of my friends. Okay.
And we'll go to the left there as well.
Thank you. Lydia, I'd like to thank you for sharing your passion and your recipes all these years. I have two questions. One, did your father get to see your success? And two, what is your opinion of the slow food movement that has taken over the world and, of course, was started in Italy?
My father saw part of my success, but I'm sure he's following it. He passed away in 1980. And I opened for Lydia in 81. So the first two restaurants, the initial restaurants, were really, they were a big support and part of it. He was part of that. And the last book I dedicated to him because he deserves it. The second question... The slow food movement. I believe in the slow food movement. I mean, Petrini is a dear friend of mine. I think that in this whole movement of food going so fast forward that we lost what food, the meaning of real food, and trying to sort of hold back the wheel and really stay with tradition and meaningful food and seasons. And that's one of the things that, you know, I always look for when I go to Italy. Are they going to lose it? Are they? And I don't think they are. And I think that the slow food movement is partially responsible. I think Italians just love to eat too much to give it up. So I think that the slow food movement, which is now an international movement, is very valid. The philosophy really is what it should be, what we all should sort of eventually live by. The traditional products, which are so important, not only for Italy, but for every culture. If you don't have those traditional products, you lost your tradition. You know, everything becomes homogenized. And we don't want that. I certainly don't. So it's a very valid movement.
Let's keep moving with the questions. Another one? Okay, in the fourth row on the aisle. Fifth row.
I am lucky enough to be of Italian-American descent from a family of mothers and grandmothers who cooked. So when I watch your show, I really relate to it, as do my children and my grandchildren. And even my six-year-old grandchild has said, look, Mom, Lydia has the same tile on her floor in her kitchen that Bibi does. But my question to you is, were you trying to be a mentor in your cookbooks to teach us the foods of Italy and not to be afraid of them?
That is one of the goals. You know, I really want to extend the easiness and the pleasure that I have in handling cooking food and how much it could bring and how much it could better everybody's life, I think, and, you know, this sensibility. And what I sensed out there was that just people loved Italian. America is in love with Italy. They love Italian style, art, and the food is the carrier of that message. And if one can do it in their own home, if you can emulate that message in their own home, then that's... And if I could be the instrument to that goal, then, you know, and I still do, I feel very special. My personal, because, you know, it's not only altruistic in this sense, you know, and I analyzed it many times. Why? Why did I get this passion? Why did I commit my whole life? I left there when I was 12, and I came here. And so it's twofold, the answer. When we left what became Yugoslavia and ultimately escaped back into Italy. Now, my mother, my brother, and myself were allowed to leave, not the whole family. My father stayed behind, and he literally had to escape the border and meet us. But I remember when I left, I did not say goodbye to my grandmother because they didn't tell me because a child spills the beans, so I couldn't. So when we left, I almost felt there was an unfinished business, and I think that I continued to connect with my grandmother and all that through food. The food was the connector, the line of me being connected to that beginning of mine with my grandmother. And so it's something that I needed to satisfy myself, my own longings. And from that stemmed that I wanted to leave it for my children, my grandchildren, and my family. In that process, I shared it with all of you. But it also is a personal kind of history for my family and grandchildren and so on.
Right here. In the...
I have a comment and a question. When you were talking about eating at the table, I think another good thing about learning to cook, although I resented being the only daughter with brothers that I had to stay in the kitchen and cook with, is that you learn all the family stories, because cooking is very repetitive and chopping, and so I think that's an important thing. But here's the question I have for you is that I heard some famous chef, I don't know who it was, saying that when you make a recipe with tomatoes or you make a recipe with apples, you should always use two varieties because you'll get a little different flavor and a little different texture. So when they were asking about the tomatoes, I wonder if you find that also.
There's truth to that, certainly, you know, that if you put two different things together, you get the complexity of those two things. And sometimes one enhances the other. And that's part of a chef and cooking, to know what sort of brings out another flavor, or the combination of the two becomes so. Absolutely, you know, the combination of different things will always give you more complexity to the dish. That there's a particular rule to that, I don't know, or two tomatoes, different tomatoes for sauce, that I don't know.
And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 rows back.
Yes. First, I'd like to say that even though it may be unintentional, I really appreciate all the vegetarian recipes that you put on your show and in your books. They are wonderful. I was wondering how much of the year you spend in the United States and how much you are in Italy, mm-hmm. and in what part of the United States you live here. Thank you.
The vegetarian part, I love vegetables. And again, you know, I think because food reflects who we are, it is part of, it's sort of a profile. The food that we eat is a profile of who we are. It trickles down into our generations of our family. Even the favorite foods that we have, I think, you know, my father loved his bacalao mantecato for Christmas Eve, and every single year I have it, and every single year I know he's with us. And that's my connection, I know. So I think that, you know, my cooking the vegetables maybe is going back, because there wasn't that much meat that we ate, you know. It was, meat was, you know, the courtyard animals, the chickens or whatever, and it was all in the right proportion, but it wasn't that we had big steaks every night or big pieces of meat. So I think it reflects the style, which really was more about vegetables, maybe legumes, and starches like polenta or whatever. I spend in Italy about 3 months a year. The summer, we still go there on vacation, 3 to 4 months, and then the rest is kind of in different spurts. I'll go for Vinitaly. I'll go to do some events or some filming or some. I live in New York City, one of the boroughs of New York City, and Douglaston Manor, which is 70 miles from Manhattan.
In the middle here, about 8 rows back. If you can keep your hand up.
I was wondering if there is a cuisine, other than Italian, obviously, that you admire and would like to attempt someday and have not yet, or if there's something that you would even incorporate into the Italian cuisine that you mastered.
Well, I feel that, you know, I'm a communicator of the Italian tradition, so it would be sacrilegious for me to add something on, not that I don't do it, but, you know, to really make it official. And as far as, you know, the recipes that I have, you know, people say, oh, these are your recipes. None of them are my recipes. They all belong to the Italian culture. And I found them someplace or other, and I sort of modified them or, but always with intense respect in retaining what that recipe meant, where I got it from. So it's, the cuisines that I can mix, and I'm thinking, no. But the cuisines that I love, besides the Italian, and I love to explore, is the Oriental cuisines, being Thailand, being Vietnamese, being all of that. I think, you know, the Chinese culinary culture is a great culture. I mean, like, Italian has its place, but I think it just tells so much about the people, how they live and whatever, and I love it. It's so diversified, so in tune with again, existence and seasons and so on. I think, you know, I'm getting interested ever more in the Middle Eastern cuisine, the other Mediterranean cuisines. Explore them. I mean, you know, Sicily and all of that, you kind of come close to that, and the couscous and all of that, but on the other side, we're starting from Morocco, going into Egypt, again to Lebanon, Israel, all of that, that interests me presently.
Got time for a couple of more questions right here in the second row.
What do you think about America's obsession with dieting?
With dieting? I think it's an obsession, and you know, an obsession dominates you, and I think we should liberate ourselves and enjoy food. I just think that there's a lot of negation about food. No's. Food is, you know, negativeness about food not being good. Well, food is all good for you. It has to be in the right proportions, the right amounts, and cooked properly. So whenever I hear, don't eat this, don't eat that, I am skeptical. Just eat, enjoy. I think, you know, one of the things that leads us to overeating is specifically that we don't gratify ourselves. We don't enjoy. I mean, if you have a good meal, and if you look at an Italian meal, and it's, you know, layered in courses, and the first one is, and I'm going through now, a good meal is a lot of different antipastos, a lot of different flavors, whether it's prosciutto, mozzarella, olives, and fish and salads, and a little bit of each. Now, you know, you have sort of experience, a lot of satisfaction, a lot of kind of sensual satisfaction, olfactory, the colors look beautiful, it tastes beautiful, and then you begin to eat and enjoy, then the next course, a little pasta again gives you that comfort and whatever. So the messages that are going to your brain is, oh, I like this, I'm getting gratified, I'm enjoying it. Now, it takes 20 minutes from the message to your brain to go to your stomach to tell, hey, stop. So in 20 minutes, you can eat a lot and do a lot of damage. So if you are gratified and begin, you're pretty, you know, I don't have to eat as much. I don't need to eat as much. And I think that it leads itself to less eating. By the time you're on the main course, you know, you might eat half as much. But the importance is diversifying those things, so that gives you that experience. Also, nutrition, it makes nutritional sense. Now, if you begin with a steak and potato, you're going to need a lot of that to satisfy you up here and to really fill you. So I think that, you know, thinking of satisfying your senses and the pleasures of the table and eating and taking your time and savoring has a lot to do with overeating.
Final question, 1, 2, 3, 4, back.
Yes, Lydia. You made reference to different generations, professional men, parents, children, but there's a lot of generations that haven't been mentioned, the X generation, millennium, and the respect for food, which you portray and believe, as well as many of us in the audience, I'm sure, just doesn't seem to be there with the middle generations, the millennium children, the X generation. You are in many audiences. I mean, do you see those generations in the audience? Do you have contact with them?
I do.
What is your concern, good, bad, or indifferent, about their lack of respect for food?
Well, okay, so let me address this. I think it's maybe not their immediate fault. I think just that they were not exposed, you know. I mean, if somebody is not part of their understanding and growing up, and then you can't expect them to understand it and respect it. So I think, let's go back one further, is we as parents, is it our fault? Maybe to some extent it's not only our fault, it's the whole industrial revolution and trying to make, you know, getting out there and living well, making money, having all these commodities at our fingertips and letting big industry drive what we eat and how we eat and so on. So it's a accumulation of all of those things, and I don't think anybody is single-handedly responsible for it. But what I do see is that when I have my book signing, and even looking at here today, it's a diversified audience. There are young people, you know, if you're talking about anywhere from the age of 20 to 40. It is consciousness that's coming back. And it also it is because there is this consciousness in the whole all of us are thinking. Are thinking right, eating right, nutrition, green, and all of that. So there is this movement out there, and these young people are very in tune, very conscious, very informed, and they are responding on their own. So they're kind of going retro on their own, learning what they didn't, and hopefully going forward, their children will have. So it's a question about, I think, education and the opportunity to learn things and appreciate and going forward. And I think the children, you know, I mean, from infancy, even in the womb, it's so important that mothers do cook and eat diversified, because, you know, all of that permeates the smell. If the child is suckling on a mother's milk, the flavors, I know that, you know, we were told don't eat garlic because the baby will get gas. So the flavors are coming to the baby, the smells of what's cooking in the in the kitchen is coming to the baby. These are all memories or recordings that are recorded in the library, reference library, if you will, of the brain of flavors. And when they grow up, these flavors will not be strange to them. You can't put a piece of broccoli in front of an 8-year-old if he had never smelled it or seen it or cooked before because, you know, it's an odd smell, the sulfur in it really sometimes. And so I think that this needs all to happen, and it is happening slowly.
Lydia Bastianic.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.